I love the way he, like, you know, the Tesseract tells off his own son, like, don't just kick him in the butt while he's talking, but then he tells him, but if he does, just keep going.
Yeah.
You're listening to the podcast for those who have looked beyond the edge of the world
and can't stop talking about it.
Welcome to Talking Beasts
from NarniaWeb.com,
where we explore the world of C.S. Lewis
and keep a watchful eye
on the latest Narnia movie news.
This is Talking Beasts.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back. I'm your host, Rillian.
And I am not your host, but I'm Glumpuddle.
You're one of the hosts.
Yeah, I guess so.
You're hosting. You're helping to host.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you.
But we had a great discussion last time with myself and not the host, Glumpuddle, I guess. But yep. Had one of the biggest topics, surprisingly, was just the pronunciation of one of the characters' names.
Actually, we got a comment about that.
We did.
Jill Poltoo thinks it's Lazarine, and I'm wanna yeah. Anyway, it's a lot better than Lassie.
Better than Lassie, but in the last episode, we covered Erebus meeting her friend, Lazarine.
However
you mean to pronounce it. She starts to help her escape and starts to lead us into this next chapter.
Which was unexpectedly awesome. I just say unexpectedly because I just don't know if I gave this seen enough attention, I think, until I reread it to this podcast.
But first off, we had some great comments on the last episode.
Well, if I can make a quick announcement, is that okay?
Oh, wait, you're right. I skipped over the bullet point.
Excuse me.
I'm sorry.
Gotcha.
I'm sorry.
What was the point of even talking before we started recording, really? And if we're just going to jump around here, it's going to be pure anarchy.
We specifically said after we talk about the discussion, we're going to allow Glumpuddle to make an announcement. We specifically said that, and then I just railroaded over him. Anyway,
go ahead and
make the announcement.
So, believe it or not, the Prince Caspian movie is going to be 10 years old very shortly. On May 16th, Prince
That's
Caspian
insane.
Movie will be 10 years old. I know. So we're going to be having a Prince Caspian watch party on May the 12th, and that is just a set time where Narnia Webbers can log online, and we're going to synchronize our movies, whether that's your DVD, Blu-ray, digital file, illegal pirated copy, whatever. I don't want to know about it.
Not approve.
We'll have a way for everyone can synchronize their movies and hit play, and then we'll just be in the chat room and chat about it and reflect on it, and we'll be having a live commentary going with, hopefully, myself, Rillian, and Jim Fan. As well, but the main
Hopefully.
Thing will be yeah
will
to
try to be there.
Yeah, the main thing will be to reminisce and kind of give a retrospective on the movie. It was obviously a very divisive movie, and kind of our thoughts on it after 10 years. And it's been, I can't believe it's been 10 years since it came out. It's been about 9.5 years since we did a commentary on it. Pencil that in. We don't have an exact time set yet, but Saturday, May 12th. Log on to NarniWeb. Once we'll have the time announced shortly. And even if you didn't like the movie, well, please come. Because obviously, Rillian and I have mixed feelings, but overall, we tend to kind of lean towards liking it. But even if you didn't like it, we really want you there to balance things out and offer your perspective. Basically, I want to stir the pot and get a good debate going in the chat room.
Definitely. So, and I might even reread the books or the book, and that can never be tainted. And speaking of books, I have a stump question for Glumpuddle to think about for this episode.
Nice transition.
For the book. Yeah, you see what I did there? See what I did there?
Mark of a good host.
So here is your stump question, Glumpuddle. And it's maybe not fair because I'm not sure I would get it 100% correct. But it's a good one. And if anyone could get it correct, I think you could. So this goes into a bit of the backstory behind the Chronicles of Narnia. At least you have to know a little bit more of the backstory to be able to get this question correct. So here is your question to ponder for the duration of the episode. In what order were the Chronicles of Narnia books completed?
Completed. Okay. So
meaning like when were they finished being written? Not necessarily started being written.
When did C.S. Lewis actually finish writing them? Okay.
In what order did he finish writing them?
We know about publication order. We know about chronological order, but what order did he actually write them? Okay. I think I could take a stab at this, but I'll wait till the end of the episode, of course.
Okay. Okay.
All right. Comments.
Comments.
All right. We can actually reply to them because we're recording this just days before it goes online. So last time it was really annoying to have to not be able to do that. But we got a lot of really good comments. It has really enriched my perspective, I think, on you know that character I'm talking about. I'll go with Jill Poltu's pronunciation, say Lazarine. So the question came up, is Lazarine, you tend to think of her more as a good character or a bad character? If we were to make a list of the good guys and the bad guys, which list would she go on? There's characters like the White Witch and the Lady of the Green Kirtle and Tash. It's obvious which list they go on. But where does Lazarine go? And I've kind of been pondering that. And I think prior to reading the comments the past couple weeks, I kind of thought of her as more of a bad character. So here's one comment from Narnie Weber Larry. Larry writes.
Hi, Larry.
Hey, Larry. Larry writes. Lazarine was silly, but not completely bad. She is indeed kind of like Suze in The Last Battle, excessively interested in fashion and trivial things. But she was close to being a friend of Narnia in her helping of Erebus and the Narnians. She is at least partially good in her kindness, showing hospitality to Erebus, and with her positive attitude. It's kind of hard not to like her, even with her faults and foolishness. And so, yeah, that got me thinking about Lazarine. I wonder what happened to her after this encounter with Erebus.
I definitely agree. It is hard not to like her.
We're jumping ahead a little bit in our discussion because, like, after the scene we're going to talk about shortly, after overhearing what the Tisserock and Rabadash are really like, in case there was any doubt, what did she do with that? Did she change it all after that? So thinking about that and just wondering, I don't know, especially with under Erebus's influence, Erebus getting the chance to see someone saying, no, I don't want those things. There's got to be more to life than that. And Erebus was willing to die rather than marry Ahashta. Like, what would all these things have done to Lazarine? Anyway, that's what I've been pondering thanks to these comments.
I mean, sometimes you do kind of wonder. She's certainly more lifelike, maybe not lifelike is the right word, life-filled character. She's a little more rounded in some ways than some of the other temporary characters that just pop into the story. And I think you'd certainly be more likely to wonder what happened to her than some of the other characters throughout the story. You feel kind of bad for her at the end.
Yeah, I think I do now. I just wonder what happened to her. And
will she really be happy?
Yeah. So thanks to everybody. Thanks to everybody. Next one from Jay Peterson. Jay Peterson mentioned C.S. Lewis's essay, an excellent essay that if you're a fan of Narnia, you should absolutely read. It's called On Three Ways of Writing for Children. Jay Peterson mentioned that because we were talking about how in the one of the past, was it the last episode or the one before? The one where we talked about the tombs of the ancient kings, about how Lewis doesn't talk down to children at all. Like Shasta has this irrational fear of the ghouls, and Lewis treats that as being serious. So Jay Peterson posted a couple excerpts from Lewis's essay on this, and there's one excerpt I wanted to take a look at. So I'm going to read really quick. And again, I would recommend reading the whole essay. But this comes from C.S. Lewis's essay on Three Ways of Writing for Children. We must meet children as equals in that area of our nature where we are their equals. The child as reader is neither to be patronized or idolized. We talk to him as man to man. But the worst attitude of all would be the professional attitude, which regards children as a sort of raw material which we have to handle. I will not say that a good story for children could never be written by someone in the Ministry of Education, but I should lay very long odds against it. Once in a hotel dining room, I said rather too loudly, I loathe prunes. So do I, came an unexpected 6-year-old voice from another table. Sympathy was instantaneous. Neither of us thought it was funny. We both knew that prunes are far too nasty to be funny. That is the proper meaning between man and child as independent personalities. I don't have a ton to add to that, except I just wanted to read that excerpt on here and encourage readers to Google it, C.S. Lewis on Three Ways of Writing for Children, because there's a lot of really excellent stuff in there.
I don't think I've read that.
It's really awesome. And it's online, actually. So like I will include the link in the description, actually.
Excellent. Thanks.
And finally, we have a comment from Colonel Clink. And Colonel Clink has been waiting a while because of the way we split up the episode into two. The last one has been waiting a while for us to answer this one. So thank you for your patience, Colonel Clink. But Colonel, and this will kind of transition us to our topic for today, but Colonel Klink asks, does the Tisrock, may he live forever, really believe... Now, hang on. So first off, Colonel Klink, we're free Narnians here. We don't have to say, may he live forever. I'm going to go ahead and edit my Google Doc and cut that out. There we go. I mean, after all, we know he's not going to live forever. I don't want him to live forever. We know he's not to, whether I want him to or not, as a wise horse once said. Anyway, Colonel Klink. Colonel Klink writes, does the Tisrock really believe Ahashta's flattery? The Tisrock seems like a pretty sharp guy. He can tell that attacking the Narnians is probably going to fail. He can tell that Ahashta doesn't really like Rabadash. He can tell that Rabadash probably doesn't really like him. So does the Tisrock really believe Ahashta's claims about how much he loves him? And if not, why does he keep him around? What do you think, Rillian?
No, I don't think he really believes any of it. I think he sees through everything.
I think he still likes to hear it, though.
Yeah. Yeah, he likes to hear it.
It's a total power thing.
It's a power grab, and I'm not. I don't like the Marxist lens of, well, all these different social dynamics are really power dynamics. But in this case, I think it certainly is. It's not even so much just a power grab as much as he has the power. It's more of an ego fill for him. It's satisfying to see people grovel, and satisfying to see his son risk his life, knowing just for the glory of his own kingdom. Not even really the kingdom, just the glory of his own name. So
just speaks to how hollow their whole culture is. Like, they have their cute little sayings they just kind of say but don't really mean. Yeah. And even though the Tisrock knows that the flattery is not sincere, whatever, he still eats it up anyway.
Yeah,
it's
and
so
we
hollow.
And we discuss the sayings and stuff later in this episode. But, yeah. You know, the Tisrock, he knows he's not going to live forever.
Right.
You know,
one would hope.
That.
One would hope.
Yeah.
Cool. Which transitions us
to this current chapter.
This is Narnia Nana with another Narnia Nugget. I will be reading an abridged excerpt from Chapter 8 of The Horse and His Boy. Erebus and Lacerilene are hiding behind a sofa, listening to the Tisrock, his son Rabadash, and Ahashta the Vizier react to the news that the Narnians have escaped Teshban. "Oh, my father, and oh, the delight of my eyes!" began the young man, muttering the words very quickly and sulkily, and not at all as if the Tisrock were the delight of his eyes. "May you live forever, but you have utterly destroyed me. Now the whole day has been wasted, and they are gone, gone, out of my reach. The false jade, the..." And here he added a great many descriptions of Queen Susan, which would not look at all nice in print. For of course this young man was Prince Rabadash, and of course the false jade was Susan of Narnia. "Compose yourself, O my son," said the Tisrock. "But I want her," cried the prince. "I must have her. I shall die if I do not get her. False, proud, black-hearted daughter of a dog that she is. I cannot sleep, and my food has no savor, and my eyes are darkened because of her beauty. I must have the barbarian queen."
"How well it was said by a gifted poet," observed the vizier, raising his face, in a somewhat dusty condition, from the carpet, "that deep draughts from the fountain of reason are desirable in order to extinguish the fire of youthful love."
This seemed to exasperate the prince. "Dog," he shouted, directing a series of well-aimed kicks at the hindquarters of the vizier, "do not dare to quote the poets to me. I have had maxims and verses flung at me all day, and I can endure them no more." I'm afraid Erebus did not feel at all sorry for the vizier.
We end up with this great scene with Rabadash, the Tisrock himself, and Ahashta, who I'm going to be honest, man, I completely forgot that Ahasta comes...
I always do forget.
Yeah, I just forgot that he comes into the story here. Not only that he
That's
comes
such a
in
big,
here.
Oh my gosh, when Ahasta shows up and her,
and then,
her you know,
honestly,
fiance.
It's a big ew, yuck moment, because I always, I mean, just when I hear that, I thought, oh, you know, Ahasta, some arrogant, young, dashing prince. And then, oh no, never mind.
You know? Right, let's forget about that.
Yeah, so I forgot about that portion too, but...
yeah, that's a huge dramatic, you know, Erebus is terrified she's going to be discovered. Obviously, it's bad enough having the Tisrock or anyone else discover them here, but then have her fiancé, who that's the whole reason she's running away in the first place, is to avoid it. Have him show up is a big dun-dun-dun moment, and I don't know why it is. I guess I get so caught up in the dialogue and what's going to happen with Narnia that I kind of forget about that.
Which I love the dialogue in this scene.
Oh, it's great. And by the way, they're both, there's another connection, another parallel between Shasta and Erebus is that both of them are overhearing conversations that they should not be listening to. They're not meant for their ears.
I hadn't thought of that. So Shasta,
they think he's Corin, and so they're talking very freely. They don't realize he's just some peasant boy overhearing all this. And of course, Erebus and Lacerilene are hiding and listening to. Listening to their plan, so I love the parallels between the two storylines ultimately come together.
Which I guess if you were watching them kind of contemporaneously, if you were watching them side by side, the way a film would typically depict it, I guess because this one is taking place after the Narnians have left, Shasta's portion would take place first.
Yes, if you, but I guess you'd have to do that. You couldn't exactly if you were doing this in a movie. You couldn't exactly.
The Narnians have to discuss leaving before they can leave, so then they would leave.
Right, because when this conversation with the Tisrock starts, that they've already left on the Splendor Highland. The Narnians have already escaped. Yeah. That's why they're having the conversation about what do we do now. I wonder how they'll do that if they do a movie, because that is the more traditional way to approach it, is not to do the time jumping, but kind of cut back and forth, which a movie, I think in a book that can get really tedious to constantly jump back and forth to read. But in so I think what Lewis does here, it's great.
The three little dots in the middle of the page to signify, different place.
Right, that could get really tedious. And so I think what Lewis did here in the book is great. But in a movie, you can effortlessly cut back and forth. Mm-hmm. In the way that I think... kind of adaptation philosophy. Lewis did things with a book, and I was thinking of this when you had the last stump question you asked me about the Magician's Book, about how Lucy, she reads a story and then she can just vaguely remember certain parts of it that Lewis describes. How would you do that in a movie? There's no way. There's no way you can do that in a movie to like give the audience a story and then have them forget. So that's an example of Lewis taking advantage of something you could do. He's taking advantage of the medium he's in. He's doing something you could really only do in a book. So therefore, the movie should also try to do things that you can only do in a movie.
Right.
That would be good adaptation.
Yeah.
Anyway, my point here is that the time jumping Lewis does here with the two storylines tells Shasta's experience in Tashban, jumps back and tells Erebus' story in Tashban. That's great in the book, but maybe in a movie you could just find a way to cut back and forth between them.
Yeah, it might work, but anyway, it's an interesting chapter because you basically have three new characters that are introduced, and you learn a lot about them very quickly. Ahasta, to a certain extent, he's kind of he's the Grand Vizier who's really kind of strategically placing himself to just not get killed by either the Tisrock or Rabadash. Like, yeah, I love the part where the Tisrock says, "Well, of course you hope that I will live forever."
Right.
but you have an interesting power play here with the Tisrock and Rabadash, who I like the Tisrock as a he's kind of a backstage villain, kind of the wizard behind the curtain to a certain extent. I mean, he's not really moving a whole lot, but he's there. He's kind of this powerful presence of evil in the story.
Uh-huh.
And Rabadash, I really don't like annoying villains, but I like the villain of Rabadash because you love to hate him. Like, because it's kind of a delicate balance, because if a villain's going to be kind of annoying, you have to, of course, have it be gratifying whatever happens to them in the end. It needs to have a good payoff. But,
and this has a great payoff, of course.
And it is a great payoff, but it also works, and it's all within the context of, hey, you have this bigger villain. It's not like you have this kind of an impetuous idiot being the only force of evil. You kind of have this, which it's easy to forget that Kalorman is the more powerful kingdom.
Yeah.
And you kind of forget it until you start reading, oh wait, Kalorman is this enormously powerful kingdom. It's the empire.
Right.
And then you have these little tiny kingdoms up north.
Yeah. And I think
It just wants to swallow up all the northern kingdoms.
Right. It is really easy to forget that. There's a lot in here I forgot about. It wasn't until, you know, we're going to go into some of our favorite dialogue in a moment here, and you asked me, hey, find something in the book. You just sent me a text and said, find something in the book that is, oh, I love this dialogue here. So I was paying close attention to it. There are so many things, and this is fantastic dialogue. Mm-hmm. Usually when I say, oh, the horse and his boy has great dialogue, I'm generally referring to the four main characters.
Right.
This is fantastic, and there's so many details I forgot about, like, for me, it's all about how utterly clueless they are about the way Narnians think. Like, mm-hmm. for Rabadash's, I think it's Rabadash's basically saying, well, if I just go and kidnap Susan and bring her back, I mean, the High King might not mind having his nephew sit on the throne of Calorman one of these days.
Yeah, and I like how
what?
Ahoshtay goes, well, you know, here's a good point. You know, it may be that after you do this, they'll realize, oh, he really does care about her. And then he's going, that's a good point. And I'm going,
maybe you'll just go what? Kill a bunch of Narnians and take Susan back, and she'll be so impressed. She'll actually
be
fall
impressed.
In love with you.
You make a good and point, babbler, you know.
And we've just, I mean, obviously we already knew that, but we have just a couple of chapters before we're seeing the Narnians talk about how each one of them would dearly sell their lives for the queen. And they're so they can't even begin. And there's a part where they even say, oh, we have our wise sayings and poets and stuff like that. And Narnia, all they talk about is love and war. They're just so completely just looking at Narnia like, what even is this? And by the way, they have the wrong idea of what happened in Narnia just a couple decades before. I didn't catch
which
this.
Which is hilarious, because I love how legends and myths just get... this story or this culture has its own legends and myths. Of course, they have their own that are in their culture. And then, of course, they hear things about other cultures or other kingdoms, and then it takes on this life of its own. So the White Witch is her own legend in Tashmaran,
right,
that doesn't reflect reality at all.
But what they say is, I think it's the Tisrock that says... that basically it was the kids that the four Pevensies came and did some kind of incantation.
Well, it's because he saw the movie.
Exactly. Sorry. I was just going to say that. The Tisrock thinks that, oh, it was the four Pevensies that said some kind of incantation and defeated the White Witch and made the snow go away, which is, they don't say an incantation in the movie, but the movie does credit the melting of the snow to the kids, not Aslan.
Yeah.
And then Rabadash comes back and says, no, I think it was just some natural turn of the weather or something like that. And they speculate about what exactly caused it. Maybe there's just this, I don't know why I just sort of gloss over a lot of this stuff in the past, but I think it's, I recognize, oh, I get it. This is plot. They're establishing Narnia is going to be attacked. Okay, I get it. I'm not really soaking in what's happening here. This, seriously, there's so much good stuff in this chapter.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I like how, and I can't even post it here, when we're looking at just the relationship with Rabadash and the Tisrock, I wrote down, are we looking at Kylo Ren versus Darth Vader here? I know, I did. But no, but it's kind of funny because I think that it is interesting how they are obviously trying to play their own role off of the other. It's kind of like this wink, wink, nod, nod. I'm not going to kill you. I'm not going to stab you to your, you know, I'm going to stab you in the back, and you know I'll stab you in the back, but I'm going to, you know, I'm not going to do it to your face. I'll just, you know.
They're working together and they're trying to destroy the other at the same time.
And they know that.
It's great.
And they know that they're trying to destroy the other at the same time. So Rabbit is just kind of like, well, how can I position myself to be a more powerful emperor, but I got to do it so that my dad doesn't get real mad and so he doesn't kill me before I can, because I have to say he's going to live forever, you know? And it's this,
Completely the opposite of the conversation we saw Shasta over here, where to them it's all about saving the queen's honor, and each one of them is so selfless and ultimately serving something greater than themselves. Here's two rulers that are, you know, on the outside, it seems like they're working together. They're actually working to destroy the other.
Oh, and
it couldn't be any more different.
Once Rabadash leaves, the Tisrock even says, he says, I also love none of these things being his son or really his son's life. He says, I also love none of these things in comparison with the glory and strength of my throne. And then he knows his history. He says, more than five Tisrocks in Tashban have died before their time because their eldest sons, enlightened princes, grew tired of waiting for their throne. He better cool his blood abroad than boil it in inaction here. And so I love that he's basically saying, well, I'll send him away. He might die, but, you know, at least it'll, you know, satisfy him and keep him from trying to kill me, which he knows that he's going to do.
I am kind of overloading right here over how many great little things are in this chapter. Yeah, that's all I got right now.
You're geeking out. Glumfuddle's geeked out. Well, okay, here, here, this will cool you. This will cool you down.
Not
so,
very. It's I'm enjoying geeking out, but not very fun to listen
to. So, the plot to retake Arkenland. Does this strike you as a weakness in the story? Because I'm not the most on the biggest history buff in the world, but I'm a little bit of a history buff, and I have a Ewart Oakeshott book over in the corner, which anyone who knows Ewart Oakeshott, he's one of the greatest sword historians of all time and armor historians, but. I mean, I just think that 200 horses to storm. It just seems a little bit simple and not very. If I were making the movie, I would want them to make it just a little more, not so huge that it just becomes overwhelming. But I would. It just seems like
they are catching Arkenland off guard.
I know, but it just seems a little bit.
Arkenland is at peace, and which oh my gosh, that's just dirty. Arkenland is officially at peace until they catch them off guard. And maybe it's a thing where Arkenland, they could, I mean, again, technically conquer them very easily. Maybe it's more of, okay, catch you off guard, and hey, just so you know, you're ours now. You know there's nothing you can do about that. We're way bigger than you are. Because all they have to do is just get Arkenland out of the way so they can get to Narnia.
Yeah, I don't know. I just thought it was a little bit weak. The numbers seem a bit sparse, that's all.
I mean, yeah, it's possible that this is a completely mad idea, and Rabadash can't see.
I guess it does
he's
fail.
So, I mean, he's being well. It fails because Prince Kor arrives and saves the day. So, I guess for his heroism to really be kept intact, we have to say yes, he would have actually destroyed Arkenland or whatever. But either way, like it could be that Rabadash is just completely mad and reckless, and the Tisrock knows this and is, okay, go ahead. That's the sense we get. So if it's not a great plan, that's not that much of a plot hole.
Okay. You're right.
Either way, there's good story stuff in here.
Well done. Thank you all. It was a good evening. Thank you.
Wow, okay, one more problem put to bed.
Yeah, Glumfuddle's right.
But again, there's some great story stuff in here, but at the end of the day, it's about the awesome dialogue. One of my favorite bits is Ahashta, calls the prince mad and gets a kick as Ahashta is on his hands and knees trying, because you have the Tisrock is sitting on his throne, you have Rabadash who's standing, and Ahashta, who's the vizier, is on his hands and knees, and he says basically something like he uses the word mad describing the prince, and he gets a kick in the butt. And then it says, "Desist, O my son," said the Tisrock. "And you, estimable vizier, whether he desists or not, by no means allow the flow of your eloquence to be interrupted. For nothing is more suitable to persons of gravity and decorum than to endure minor inconveniences with constancy." "To hear is to obey," said the vizier, wriggling himself round a little so as to get his hinder part further away from Rabadash's toe. I completely forgot about that bit. I love the Tisrock.
So the way I'm going through this, because I've just because of my busyness and schedule, I listened to this on the way to work and from work on my commute, and I listened to this, and you have an iPod or iPhone, you have the rewind button, like the 15-second. I heard that, I thought, wait, what? And I rewound it. I think I listened to it like twice, two or three times. I thought, hey, don't, even if he kicks you, just keep going. I thought, wait, what?
Oh, I love that. It's like, I love the way the Tisrock tells off his own son, like, don't just kick him in the butt while he's talking. But then he tells him, but if he does, just keep going.
Yeah, basically. Good stuff. Good stuff.
This is brilliant.
But, I mean,
and if you've got a favorite, if any of you are like me, where you just never really, when you think of the great Narnia, the great dialogue in the Chronicles of Narnia, or some of you, the great scenes in the Chronicles of Narnia, and have overlooked this one, take another look at it, read it really closely, and you won't be disappointed. And post some of your favorite dialogue in the comments.
And by the end of the chapter, of course, Erebus and Lysarline's eyes are opened. You know, yeah. And it really just kind of removes this. It kind of destroys, really the last few chapters, it kind of just destroys this facade of the great empire, this amazing, wonderful city of Teshban, and just how incredible it is.
Yep.
And, you know, by the end of it, of course, Erebus wishes her well. And, you know, it's, I hope you'll be happy. But I won't. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to Narnia. Narnia in the north. Further up and further in.
Narnia in the north. All right.
This was good. We'll be right back.
Voices of Narnia Web.
Hello, Rillian and Glumpuddle. This is Searchlight RG. I am from the United States, at least when I'm not wandering about in Narnia, Middle Earth, or sundry fantasy lands. I would say my first exposure to Narnia, at least that I can think of, was one of my cousins had the animated Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe movie, and used to watch it whenever we'd go over to their house, because we didn't have it. I have some fond memories of that, but yeah, years later, got into the books and such, and definitely enjoyed those for the most part. Nailing down my favorite book is honestly kind of difficult. Sadly, I would have to say that my least favorite book, and I'm sorry, Rillian and Glumpuddle, this is probably going to make me the Calorman to your Arkenland in Narnia, but I really don't care for Voyage of the Dawn Treader. Just going to throw that up. Yeah, so far as favorite characters go, it's hard to say, nail that one down too. There's a lot of great ones, and I mean, obviously you want to pick Aslan, but honestly, if it would count, I would say one of my favorite characters is probably the narrator of the Chronicles of Narnia. I mean, whether you want to think of it as C.S. Lewis or just the character he gets into for narration. In particular, one of my favorite little insertions by the narrator actually takes place in The Horse and His Boy, towards the end, where he talks about how Kor and Erebus, when they grew up, had gotten so used to quarreling and making up that they got married so as to go on doing it more conveniently, which I think is both hilarious and adorable. You know, it really is great with Narnia to have a series where fantasy is blended with an aspect of faith and a higher power. It's something that's all too rare in today's world of entertainment. But yeah, just wanted to send you guys in my Voice of Narnia Web, and hope to hear it on the podcast. Talk to you later.
If you want to share what the Chronicles of Narnia means to you, send your voice to the email address in the episode description.
This is your C.S. Lewis Minute. I'm William O'Flaherty from EssentialCSLewis.com. Would you believe there is yet another work from Lewis that has a connection to his science fiction trilogy? Again, it's the final title, That Hideous Strength, which is related. It's been said this last novel is a mythological counterpart to The Abolition of Man, which is more of a philosophical work. First given as a series of three lectures in 1943, just 2 years before That Hideous Strength was published, The Abolition of Man defends the idea that moral values are objective, without bringing in any specific religious or Christian arguments. That is, Lewis rationally explains why right and wrong is not merely an opinion, but real and knowable. Find out more by picking up this slim volume that contains other deep thoughts. Learn more about the creator of Narnia at my website, EssentialCSLewis.com. Again, I'm William O'Flaherty.
And we're back. Glumpuddle, it's been fun. It's been real. Are you ready to be stumped?
Hit me!
Okay. We could both cite the publication order of the Chronicles of Narnia and the chronological order of the Chronicles of Narnia. Can you tell me the order in which they were written? And when I say written, I mean the order in which each book was completed, not necessarily started.
Okay. So he definitely, I think I can do this. I do think it's interesting. Now, obviously, me, like, I think most Narnia fans, and if you're not one of them, please post a comment. Love to hear from you. But I think certainly the vast majority of the fan base supports publication order. And I think the fact that Lewis wrote the books in a certain order and then published them in another order only gives more strength to publication order. It implies a little bit of design behind that. So here's one clue. I know that even though The Silver Chair is the fourth book published and Horse and His Boy is the fifth book published, I know he had completed The Horse and His Boy first because he teases it in The Silver Chair. There's a bit where Jill and Eustace they hear the story of Bree and Shasta, and it's in a book called The Horse and His Boy. So I know that book must have been completed first. So I'm going to go ahead and say that. I mean, we know we started with Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, and then he did Caspian, and then Dawn Treader. I'm going to say after that, The Horse and His Boy, then The Silver Chair. That leaves us with The Magician's Nephew and The Last Battle. Which one? I'm going to go ahead and say Magician's Nephew and then The Last Battle. So basically my answer is I think the only thing I would switch, I would alter from publication order is I would switch Horse and His Boy and The Silver Chair. And that is my final answer.
You are incorrect.
Ah, where'd I go wrong?
Last Battle and The Magician's Nephew. The Magician's Nephew was finished in February 1954. The Last Battle was finished in March 1953.
So you finished The Magician's Nephew. It's actually the last book that he completed. That is interesting. Next time I read the series, I'm going to read it with that in mind. But he knew
where
it was.
Very good job. You got, Horse and His Boy, Silver Chair, Voyage of Dawn Treader, those three were all, especially Voyage of Dawn Treader and Horse and His Boy, were written very close to one another.
So he wrote all the books in a space of about 4 years.
From 1949 to February 1954.
So after he finished them all, it was a few years before they were all actually out, because Wardrobe was actually published in 50, and Last Battle wasn't published until 56.
And obviously he's not, you know, writing, you know, finishing just one and then writing the other in isolation and finishing that. But still, it's kind of incredible how he, from what I was reading, Voyage of the Dawn Treader was written very quickly.
Yeah. And it's tempting to go into a soapbox on publication order versus chronological order. I've thought about doing a podcast episode on that. It just really comes down to there are very few fans who feel very strongly about chronological order. And if I can't find someone else to kind of represent the other side, it's just going to be an information dump. So if you're listening and you really feel strongly about chronological order, please post your arguments and why. Maybe we'll respond to them.
And which order you experience the books in. I'd be curious about that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Don't forget about the watch party.
Thank you. Thank you.
Are we ready to wrap this up?
Let's do the outro.
Let's do it. You've been listening to Talking Beasts, a NarniaWeb.com podcast. Be sure to subscribe and post a comment below or in the Talking Beasts Facebook group. You can also email us at podcast@NarniaWeb.com, Rillian@NarniaWeb.com, or Glumpuddle@NarniaWeb.com. Special thanks to AJ Aiken, Ryidian, and the Rose Tree Dryad. For the latest news on the Silver Chair movie, visit NarniaWeb.com. A new episode of Talking Beasts is posted every other Tuesday. Until next time, further up and further in.